our own problems.
Okay, and of course, we're keeping our eyes on this summit to see where it all goes. I appreciate both of you being with me on this spotlight. We're out of time. Emmanuel Mutombo, international affairs researcher out of the University of Johannesburg in Johannesburg, and Wesley Seal, international relations expert out of Cape Town. And as always, we thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 36 through 38 from the Surah Nahl, recited by Qasim Razi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa laqad ba'athna fi kulli ummatin rasulan an i'budullaha wajtanibut taghut. فَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ هَدَى اللَّهُ وَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ حَقَّتْ عَلَيْهِ الضَّلَالَةِ فَسِيرُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ فَانْظُرُوا كَيْفَ كَانَ على هداهم فإن الله لا يهدي من يضل وما لهم من ناصرين وأقسموا جهد أيمانهم لا يبعث الله من يموت بلى وعدا عليه حقا ولكن أكثر الناس لا يعلمون بلى وعدا عليه حقا ولكن أكثر الناس لا يعلمون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And certainly we raise in every nation an apostle, saying, serve Allah and shun the Satan. So there were some of them who Allah guided, and there were others against whom error was due. Therefore travel in the land, then see what was the end of the rejectors. If you desire further guidance, yet surely Allah does not guide him who leads astray, nor shall they have any helpers. And they swear by Allah with the most energetic of their oath, Allah will not raise up him who dies. Yeah, is a promise binding on him quite true, but most people do not know.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines, Russia says an investigation has been launched into a plane crash that left the commander of the Wagner Group and his deputy dead. Iran's president says BRICS has gathered independent countries around the same table with the main objective of confronting unilateralism. And also in our headlines, a new report says the number of Israelis requesting European passports is hitting a record high amid rising opposition to the regime's policies. Hello and welcome, everybody. Russian officials have confirmed that the commander of the Wagner Group and his deputy are on board a plane that crashed north of Moscow with no survivors. Russia's Civil Aviation Authority, Rosaviatsiya, said Yevgeny Prigozhin and Dmitry Utkin were among 10 people involved in the crash, including 3 crew members. The agency said the investigation has been launched into the crash. According to Russian emergency services, the aircraft was traveling from Moscow to St. Petersburg when it crashed. Prigozhin, 62, led an armed mutiny against Russia's military top brass in June. For more on that, we're joined by Johnny Miller, who's joining us from Moscow. Johnny, what details do you have to share with us regarding the death of Prigozhin, and what has the official statement been regarding the reasoning of the crashing of the plane?
Let's give you some of the background, of course, of this. Prigozhin, the head of private military group Wagner, very powerful until recently, doing a lot of the fighting in Ukraine. During the Battle of Barmet, which Wagner were eventually successful of, Prigozhin started to make some rather wild statements on camera, showing himself in front of dead Wagner soldiers, even at one point questioning Ukrainian war crimes in Donbass, and crucially challenging the Russian Ministry of Defense. He then, of course, led that mad march to Moscow, 8,000 or so Wagner troops heading to Moscow, many calling it an attempted coup. On the way, they shot down Russian military planes, leading to the death of 12 Russian soldiers. So a very serious and shocking event. That was 2 months ago. Vladimir Putin then came on camera and called the instigators of that march traitors. Lukashenko, the president of Belarus, then, of course, stepped in and found a way out, a peaceful way out, which perhaps saved a lot of Russian soldiers' lives. And he was sent to Belarus. Instead of going quietly into the night, so to speak, he then carried on as usual, going to Africa and also traveling back into Russia, which is against the terms of the agreement. And now we have this event, another shocking and dramatic event of this war. What happened? Their investigation is currently underway. Was it a missile? Was it a bomb? It's unlikely to have been an accident. And then who did it? Many are speculating, perhaps those in Russia. Putin had many people, frankly, who would want him dead, perhaps NATO countries, Ukraine. So we'll have to wait and see what happened with their investigation, but many will have already made up their mind with the who did it and why.
And how long before that investigation comes through, Johnny?
Well, it's just started, so we'll have to wait and see. Obviously, we don't know how complicated the investigation will be. First of all, identifying the bodies, it has to be confirmed that Prigozhin, but apparently an identification is still going to take place. And then, of course, how the plane went down. Was it a bomb, missile, an accident? We'll have to wait and see, but the investigation is underway.
Thanks a lot, Johnny Miller, joining us from Moscow. Elsewhere, Iranian president says BRICS has gathered independent countries around the same table with the main objective of confronting unilateralism. Ebrahim Raisi made the remarks ahead of his trip to Johannesburg to take part in the Friends of BRICS summit. He noted that the purpose of his visit was to elaborate Tehran's stances and to hold meetings with leaders and members of the participating countries. He added the meetings are in line with the exchange of capacities between regional and extra-regional states. BRICS is composed of five major developing economies, including Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. 40 countries have expressed interest in joining the bloc, including Iran, that applied for membership last year.
Change in the world can come if nations function on the principle of mutual cooperation and respect. But the imperative is to break free from the status quo, and BRICS leaders have a number of proposals they want implemented to realize this. Among the most urgent being accelerating de-dollarization, establishing a common currency, and countering Western-imposed sanctions.
Through the new development bank, we can offer our own alternatives for the adequate financing that will attend to the needs of the global south. Through the help of my sister Dilma Rousseff, the bank will manage to face the challenges. The creation of a common vetted unit for our trade transactions and investments for BRICS countries will increase payment options and reduce our vulnerabilities.
With an increasing number of countries wanting to join BRICS, the group presents prospects of prosperity, cooperation and development. As the sessions were underway here, India successfully landed its Chandrayaan 3 mission on the moon. And this is the type of expertise and know-how that can hopefully be shared through a mechanism such as BRICS.
Through initiatives such as the BRICS satellite constellation, the vaccine R&D center, mutual recognition of pharma products, we are bringing about positive changes in the lives of ordinary citizens in BRICS countries. Through initiatives such as the Youth Summit, BRICS Games, the Think Tanks Council, we are strengthening people-to-people ties in all countries.
The West's reliance on sanctions has inadvertently strengthened those it wanted to isolate. Russia highlighted how sanctions have hampered the international economic system. And even with traditional allies of the United States, such as Saudi Arabia, knocking at BRICS's door, change looks very much possible. BRICS now stands on the threshold of becoming a far more influential body, one which will shape a new world order and present a true challenge to the West's stranglehold. The final day of deliberations, which will look at expansion, will decide its future. Hassan Siriyap, Santon.
The Iranian Ministry of Defense and Armed Forces Logistics has unveiled a domestically produced drone named Mohajir 10 during a ceremony marking the Defense Industry Day. Iranian military experts and engineers have in recent years made remarkable accomplishments in manufacturing a broad range of indigenous equipment, making the Iranian armed forces self-sufficient.
Iran has unveiled a new drone named Mohajir 10 during a ceremony marking Defense Industry Day on Tuesday. The domestically manufactured drone was put on display during a ceremony in Tehran in the presence of President Ebrahim Raisi. Mohajir 10 has a maximum flight duration of 24 hours at an altitude of 7,000 meters and an operational radius of 2,000 kilometers. It also has a maximum fuel capacity of 450 liters and a maximum cargo weight of 300 kilograms. Equipped with electronic warfare and intelligence systems, the unmanned aerial vehicle can fly at a maximum speed of 210 kilometers per hour and carry different kinds of ammunition and bombs. Tuesday's ceremony also saw the unveiling of Arman 1 guided air-launched bomb. Meanwhile, President Raisi ordered the joining of strategic Khorramshahr and Haj Qasem missiles to the aerospace force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Marking the Defense Industry Day, Iranian commanders have hailed the country's self-sufficiency in the defense sector. Iran's Army Chief Commander, Major General Abdulrahim Mousavi, emphasized that despite sanctions, the country has been able to produce all the defense equipment required by the armed forces to protect borders. IRGC Navy Commander Rear Admiral Ali Reza Tangsiri also said that today, "We are proud of covering all the country's needs for advanced equipment through reliance on the capabilities of our youth." He further warned that the enemy will not be allowed to even think about an operation on Iranian soil. Also, in a message marking the day, Iranian Defense Minister, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani, enumerated multiple achievements in the country's defense sector over the past 2 years. According to Ashtiani, Iranian experts have managed to reduce ballistic missiles' target miss to less than 35 meters and increase their range to 2,000 kilometers. In air defense, he added, several systems have been developed in order to deal with low-altitude targets and cruise missiles.
Iran unveiled its Mohajir 10 drone during an event celebrating the Defense Industry Day, which was attended by President Ebrahim Raisi. The president lauded Iran's growing military power and cutting-edge defense technology. Raisi also stressed the Islamic Republic favors interaction with other countries, but will, quote, cut off the hands of those plotting acts of aggression against the nation.
During a ceremony on Tuesday, President of the Islamic Republic Ebrahim Raisi oversaw the unveiling of the Mohajir 10 drone, a domestically manufactured unmanned aerial vehicle. Raisi stressed that Iran's defense and nuclear industries have made the most progress despite the heaviest sanctions. The Iranian president referred to motivation, diligence, and perseverance as the main factors of success in attaining such achievements. Raisi said the Islamic Republic aims to interact with the entire world countries, adding, "We warmly squeeze the hands of anyone reaching out to us for cooperation and friendship, but our powerful armed forces will cut off the hands of those seeking to carry out an act of aggression against Iran." Earlier in the week, Iran's domestically manufactured Ababil ballistic missile was for the first time put on display at a military exhibition in Russia, alongside a range of other cutting-edge Iranian military equipment, including drones and electronic warfare systems. In the field of drones, the Defense Ministry is seriously pursuing the development of the fifth generation of strategic drones under a Drone Leap program, which also involves the development of artificial intelligence along with support, electronic warfare, and signal collection missions. In the past 2 years, the production of solid-fuel ballistic missiles as well as air defense and cruise missiles have jumped by 64, 45, and 100% respectively. In June, the Aerospace Division of the IRGC revealed its first hypersonic ballistic missile named Fatah, which can travel at the speed of sound and has a range of 1,400 kilometers. Iranian officials have described the missile as a generational leap for the Islamic Republic's military. Iranian military experts and technicians have in recent years made great progress in developing a broad range of military equipment, making the armed forces self-sufficient in the defense sector. Iranian officials have repeatedly said the Islamic Republic will not hesitate to build up its defense capabilities, emphasizing that such abilities are entirely meant for the purpose of defense and will never be subject to negotiations.
The number of Israelis requesting to obtain European passports is hitting a record high amid a cost-of-living crisis. This as the regime has been facing weekly protests for the past 7 months against the far-right cabinet of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. According to Israeli media, European embassies have reported a significant increase in requests for passports or immigration visas from Israeli settlers in recent months. Embassies of France, the Netherlands, Romania, Portugal, Spain, Germany, and Italy have received the highest number of those requests. They say there are unprecedented long lines of Israelis requesting foreign passports. The new revelation comes as Israelis are dealing with soaring consumer prices. The regime has been also witnessing deep rifts in its political ranks as Netanyahu's extremist cabinet is pushing ahead with its so-called judicial overhaul plan. In addition to weekly protests, the plan has been faced with staunch opposition within Israel's military, with thousands of reservists saying they would no longer show up for duty. The Democratic People's Republic of Korea says its second attempt to place a reconnaissance satellite in orbit has failed due to a minor problem with the rocket booster. Pyongyang said the first and second stages of the rocket were normal, but the launch failed due to an error in the third stage. The pre-dawn launch on Thursday prompted an emergency warning to Japan. In Japan, that is, the DPRK said it would conduct its third reconnaissance satellite launch in October after thoroughly probing the reason behind previous failures. The country's first satellite launch also failed in May when its new Kolyma-1 rocket crashed into the sea. South Korea and the U.S. condemned the launch as a violation of U.N. Security Council resolutions. The DPRK says it plans to place a fleet of satellites into orbit to monitor military moves by the U.S. and South Korea. The satellite launch came amid joint military drills by the U.S. and the South, which are seen by Pyongyang as rehearsals for invasion of its territory. The U.S., Japan, and South Korea have agreed to expand cooperation against threats in the Indo-Pacific. The trilateral agreement made in a summit on Friday has drawn criticism. South Korean NGOs suggest that Washington is further provoking military tensions. Frank Smith reports.
South Korea kicked off yet another round of large-scale military exercises with the U.S. by conducting Air Force drills early this week. South Korea says the joint drills are based on an all-out war scenario and will involve field training and command post exercises and address cyber threats and terrorism. The drills follow the recently concluded trilateral summit with Japan at Camp David, where President Biden warned the DPRK and other countries.
We're doubling down on information sharing, including on the DPRK's missile launches and cyber activities, strengthening our ballistic missile defense cooperation. And critically, we've all committed to swiftly consult with each other in response to threats to any one of our countries from whatever source it occurs.
The joint U.S.-South Korea drills under President Yoon actually lead to a decline in national security, say some NGO leaders.
If the large-scale military exercises of South Korea and the U.S. continue, North Korea will respond with provocations. And then strategic assets such as fighter bombers of the U.S. forces will be engaged, and the vicious cycle carries on. At this rate, these military exercises will expand further and become regular. So, of course, the tension on the Korean Peninsula will increase.
The DPRK has indicated it will launch a satellite in the coming days as it seeks to bolster its surveillance activities.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has reversed course in much of the country's foreign policy. Engagement with the DPRK has been replaced with confrontation. And while U.S. President Biden praises President Yoon for his political courage, many South Koreans oppose his policies.
Trilateral cooperation with Japan is particularly touchy in South Korea for historical reasons, and opposition to the Fukushima nuclear contaminated water release further damaged sentiment toward Japan. Frank Smith, Seoul.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible?
As Rahul Quran.
by means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من، این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
martyrdom of Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon him. In the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate. Salam and heartfelt condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon him, who was the elder grandson of the Prophet of Islam. Before we present you a special feature on the blessed firstborn son of the peerless couple, the noblest lady of all times, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, and the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him, here is a phrase worth pondering upon in its original Arabic followed by its translation in English. La yawm ka yawmika ya Aba Abdullah, meaning, no day is like your day, O Aba Abdullah. What you heard were the words of a brother to a brother. This phrase was not expressed in a moment of joy, nor was it the giving of tidings of joy. The 7th of Safar draws our attention to these famous words, especially since we continue to be in the state of mourning for history's most blood-curdling tragedy that took place on the 10th of Muharram, known universally as the Day of Ashura. It is the tragedy that occurred in Karbala in Iraq in the year 61 AH, corresponding to 680 AD, when in defense of Islam and humanitarian values, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, the Prophet's younger grandson, preferred being martyred in the famous heart-rending manner rather than acknowledge the godless rule of the libertine Yazid. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, whose kunya or agnomen was Aba Abdullah, was hailed along with his elder brother Imam Hassan as the two leaders of the youths of paradise by the Prophet on God's command. Perhaps the question might arise, where was Imam Hassan when Imam Hussein was martyred in Karbala? The answer is obvious. He was already martyred a decade earlier in 50 AH, in Medina through a fatal dose of poison. Who killed Imam Hassan and for what reason? To any person familiar with the early history of Islam, the answer is crystal clear. The Prophet's elder grandson was administered poison on the orders of Muawiyah, the despicable father of the accursed Yazid. Muawiyah, a late and reluctant convert to Islam at the surrender of Mecca in 8 AH, only 2 years before the passing away of the Prophet, was along with his father Abu Sufyan, a staunch enemy of Islam, and had claimed to become a Muslim only to save his life. It is indeed an irony of Islamic history that this same Muawiyah, despite his avowed enmity towards Islam and the Prophet, was within a few years of paying lip service to Islam, appointed governor of Syria by the second caliph. On taking charge of Syria, this charlatan left no stone unturned to weaken the Muslim society from within and distort the teachings of Islam. He refused to step down as governor when he was formally dismissed from that post by the Prophet's righteous heir, the commander of the faithful Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him. Muawiyah next came out into open rebellion by starting armed warfare against Imam Ali, peace upon him, but when faced with imminent defeat at the Battle of Siffin, he raised copies of the Holy Quran on spear points to dupe the Muslims and escape alive. After the martyrdom of the commander of the faithful in 40 AH, Muawiyah resorted to a policy of propaganda, terrorism, and bribes against his rightful successor, Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon him. The Prophet's elder grandson, aware of the flimsy faith of his own army and realizing the magnitude of the treachery of Muawiyah and the dangers of civil war between Muslims at a time when the Christian Byzantine Empire was looking for an opportunity to attack the Islamic realm and seize Baitul Muqaddas, entered into a treaty to avert bloodshed and unmask the hypocrisy of his opponent. Muawiyah, who now took charge of the rule of the Islamic State and conditioned that he would stop the imprecation of the commander of the faithful at mosques, respected tenets of Islam and returned the caliphate to the Prophet's grandson without nominating any successor on his deathbed, contrived to martyr Imam Hassan, peace upon him. In 50 AH, the 10-year imamate of the Prophet's elder grandson came to its sudden end when Muawiyah succeeded in his devilish design of administering a lethal dose of poison mixed in water. The poison rent asunder the liver of Imam Hassan, peace upon him, and he vomited its pieces with blood as death approached. The tragic sight brought tears to the eyes of his younger brother Imam Hussein, peace upon him, who started crying. At this moment, the elder brother foretold to his younger brother, "It is my destiny that I have been poisoned with trickery that would kill me. However, no day is like your day, O Abu Abdullah. On that day, 30,000 hordes from those who claim to be Muslims and part of the Ummah of our grandfather will get together to spill your blood and kill you, take your ladies and children as prisoners, and to plunder your assets. At that time, that God will allow the cursing of the Umayyads, and it will rain blood and ashes from the sky and all creatures, even the wild animals and fish in the sea will cry for you." We therefore mourn Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon him, on this day, as well as on the 28th of Safar, which according to some narrations was the fateful day of his martyrdom. At any rate, as said earlier, we are in a state of mourning for the immortal martyr of Karbala, and that is the reason we do not celebrate any event during the 2 months of Muharram and Safar. The 7th of Safar also happens to be the birthday of the Prophet's 7th infallible heir, Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, but we don't celebrate it out of respect for the martyrdom of his ancestor, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, and the tragedy that afflicted the noble ladies and children of his household. As a matter of fact, history is witness that on the advent of the month of Muharram, smile would vanish from the face of Imam Kazem, peace upon him, although almost 100 years separated his era from that of the tragedy of Karbala. On the anniversary of the tragedy of Ashura, the 7th Imam's grief would reach its peak. He would be continuously crying and was heard saying, "This is the day on which Hussein had been killed." As for Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon him, following his martyrdom, when Imam Hussein, peace upon him, and the Bani Hashim took the coffin towards the Prophet's shrine as a mark of respect before burial in the Baqi cemetery, the despicable Marwan ibn Hakam, who was then governor of Medina, ordered that arrows be shot at the briar. It is said some 70 arrows were shot at the coffin of the Prophet's elder grandson, and several of these arrows pierced his lifeless body. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, endured this insolent oppression with patience and laid Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon him, to eternal rest in the Baqi Cemetery near to the grave of his grandmother, Fatima bint Asad, peace upon her. In the subsequent generations, Imam Zainul Abidin, Imam Muhammad Baghir, and Imam Jafar Sadiq, peace upon them, were laid to rest beside Imam Hassan, peace upon him, and a grand towering mausoleum was built over the blessed tombs where pilgrims used to pay their respects, recite the Holy Quran, and pray to God Almighty. Alas, in 1925, when the heretical Wahhabi hordes of the desert brigand Abdul Aziz ibn Saud seized the land of Revelation Hijaz by shedding torrents of Muslim blood, these savage hordes desecrated and destroyed the holy shrine of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt. Dear listeners, here we present you some aphorisms from Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon him, to ponder upon. A blessing is trial if gratitude is shown for it. It becomes a blessing, and if you show ingratitude for it, then it becomes a wrath. One who lacks intelligence has no decorum, and one who lacks determination has no magnanimity, and one who has no modesty has no religion. Abstain from the unlawful and you will be a worshipper, and be content with what Allah has predestined for you, you will be sufficient. Be benevolent to those who take up proximity in your neighborhood. You will be a Muslim. Do not be hasty in punishing someone's sin, and leave room between the two, fault and punishment, for apology.
Imam Ali, peace be upon him, said, "The Lord Most High has chosen for us certain followers, Shiites, who assist us. If we are joyful, they are joyful. And if we are sorrowful and sad, they are sorrowful and sad."
Years of U.S. presence in Afghanistan.
1.
Sky may be the only place you can find peace in Afghanistan. Because from up here, bad incidents become so small that they're not visible anymore. If the only criterion is people, life in Afghanistan goes on, like anywhere else in the world. In here, people live together despite their differences. In today's Afghanistan, it doesn't matter if life goes on fast or slowly. In here, incidents set the cycle of life in motion, or even stop it. People have no role in these incidents. The incidents come to the country from outside. The problem in Afghanistan today is these incidents. If you type Afghanistan in Google, you'll come across many military and horrible incidents. This is the United Nations Happiness Index for different countries. In 2020, Afghanistan ranked last on the list of all the countries in the world. This report reveals a bitter reality. The question is, what put Afghanistan in this situation in recent years? Maybe if we go back 2 decades in time, we can find an answer to our question. 2 decades before 2021 was 2001. Afghanistan's destiny changed that year.
Moments later, the president walked in.
It was interesting.
On September 11th, 2001, then U.S. President George Bush was visiting a school.
Greeted the children.
His worried face revealed that something concerning had happened. At 8:46 a.m., the first tower was targeted. At 9:03 a.m., the second tower was hit. A major event was unraveling. 4 suicide missions with passenger planes in a single day. 9:37 a.m., the Pentagon. 10:03 a.m., an explosion and a plane crash in Pennsylvania. According to Bush, everything was clear and obvious. But was this really the reality?
Who attacked our country? The evidence we have gathered all points to a collection of loosely affiliated terrorist organizations known as Al-Qaeda. This group and its leader, a person named Osama bin Laden.
Bob Graham, former governor of Florida, and the head of the 9/11 fact-finding commission. The commission made a detailed report on the terrorist attacks in 2003. Parts of the report were published. It's known as the 28-page document. The role of Saudi Arabia and the Bush administration was a fact Bob Graham and his colleagues highlighted.
The release of the 28 pages received a variety of interpretations. There were some who said that this confirmed the Saudi link to the 9/11 hijackers. Did these 19 people, most of whom did not speak English, most of whom had never been in the United States before, most of whom were not well educated. Did they carry out this sophisticated task alone, or did they have some form of support while they were in the United States? If the answer is they had some support, who provided that support?
A hidden network that spread from Riyadh to the White House. At the head of the network, there was a Saudi man named Bandar bin Sultan. He was Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the U.S. from 1983 to 2005. He was the head of the National Security Council for some time. He was also the head of the Saudi spy agency from 2012 to 2014. His influence in the Bush administration paved the way for the tragic event. This picture dates back to September 13, 2001, 2 days after the September 11th attacks. Bandar bin Sultan, along with Bush and his team, are on the Truman balcony of the White House.
Almost 3,000 American victims and their families deserve justice. They deserve the right in a court of law to be able to present the evidence that they have gathered, which is voluminous, that will link the kingdom and other entities of Saudi Arabia to the 19 hijackers.
All the fact-finding commission was saying was Saudi Arabia was behind the 9/11 attacks. But the most obvious question is, then why did the U.S. attack Afghanistan immediately after the 2001 attacks? If the U.S. was supposed to attack somewhere, it should have been Saudi Arabia, not Afghanistan.
On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan.
On October 7, 2001, the CIA Special Forces were the first Americans who entered Afghanistan via Pakistan, and the large-scale aerial attacks followed afterwards. From New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania to Kabul, Herat, and Kandahar, the false flag 9/11 attacks were the excuse to rein in the impoverished country. Afghanistan had no role in what had happened. It's really interesting that Fox News saying, according to a survey, 92% of the youth in Afghanistan have not even heard anything about the 9/11 attacks. The U.S. did not set foot in Afghanistan for the first time in 2001, but it was the early 1980s. The importance of Afghanistan's oil and gas reserves in Central Asia started a new rivalry between the Soviet Union and the U.S.
Massive Soviet military forces have invaded the small, non-aligned, sovereign nation of Afghanistan. A Soviet-occupied Afghanistan to possible control over much of the world's oil supplies.
In 1979, the Soviet forces occupied Afghanistan. Carter immediately tasked the CIA with taking countermeasures. Zbigniew Brzezinski, Carter's national security advisor, came up with a scheme. He decided to deploy some radical and Arab militia forces in Afghanistan.
We know of their deep belief in God, and we are confident that their struggle will succeed. That land over there is yours. You'll go back to it one day because your fight will prevail, and you'll have your homes and your mosques back again because your cause is right and God is on your side.
On the other hand, he decided to organize the domestic militia forces. Money, weapons, and extremism. It was a dangerous combination.
When the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, We had this brilliant idea that we were going to come to Pakistan and create a force of Mujahideen, equip them with Stinger missiles and everything else to go after the Soviets inside Afghanistan. And we were successful. The Soviets left Afghanistan. And then we said, great, goodbye, leaving these trained people who were fanatical in Afghanistan and Pakistan, leaving them well armed.
Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S., sought to export the Wahhabi ideology to Afghanistan through Arab militants. One of its clear examples was bin Laden. As a Saudi national, he was linked to the powerful Saudi network.
Let's go recruit these Mujahideen, and let's great, let's get some to come from Saudi Arabia and other places, importing their Wahhabi brand of Islam.
In the end, it was the Afghan people who fell victim to the war between the U.S. and Soviet Union. The tragic thing was extremist Wahhabism crept into Afghanistan.
Their support for the 9/11 hijackers has been to encourage Saudi Arabia to be involved in more of the same. They've continued to fund al-Qaeda. They were a significant part of the establishment of ISIS. They have supported madrasas, which teach young people hatred and intolerance, of mosques, which preach jihad to adults. All those things have happened after 9/11.
The U.S. and Saudi support for radicalism in Afghanistan did not end with extremist militias or al-Qaeda. Daesh was a new disaster that came to Afghanistan. Hundreds of dead and wounded was the result of Daesh presence in Afghanistan.
Why was it that this extremism came from your schools and from your mosques?
And in part, I blame ourselves also in hindsight. Because are there things that we could have done? Probably. But at the time that this was all, that all these forces were being unleashed, you deal with them at the time.
Under such circumstances and due to the insecurity in Afghanistan, although the U.S. had spent over $2 trillion in the country from 2001 to 2021, it failed to restore minimum peace to the country. To get a clear picture of how big the number is, think of, for example, $62 billion. It is almost equal to the U.S.'s annual budget needed to stay in Afghanistan. It is more than the entire U.K. military budget and more than the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's budget. After the massive failure in Afghanistan, Trump decided to put an end to U.S. presence in Afghanistan.
Why are we there? We're 6,000 miles away. Where Taliban is here, ISIS is here, and they're fighting each other. I said, why don't you let them fight? Why are we getting in the middle of it? I said, let them fight. They're both our enemies. Let them fight. They go in and they end up fighting both of them. It's the craziest thing I've ever seen.
With Trump's strategy, it was predictable that he would face major differences with the U.S. military commanders. The top military official regarding Afghanistan was General James Mattis.
Do you agree that we're not winning in Afghanistan?
Sir, I understand the urgency. I understand it's my responsibility. We're not winning in Afghanistan right now.
He confessed to the failure in Afghanistan and believed that the process of failure had been expedited because of Trump's measures. That's why Trump was dissatisfied with General Mattis more than anyone else. As he was a businessman, Trump's economic approach was meant to make profits in Afghanistan, or at least make up for the money spent in the country. Blackwater is a notorious name among private security contractors. Eric Prince was the director of the firm and Trump's unofficial military advisor. Prince tried to provide an answer for Trump in Afghanistan. He presented Trump with a plan to tackle the financial loss in Afghanistan. First of all, Eric Prince knew well that the U.S. Army has failed in Afghanistan.
The mighty U.S. military
the most powerful and expensive military in the history of mankind gets defeated by largely illiterate goat herders using very simple weapons, AKs, PKs, Dishkas, and homemade explosives. Please, be honest with ourselves. Who could say that our 17 years, trillions of dollars, 2,400 U.S. dead, tens of thousands of wounded has been a raging success? I would disagree.
Secondly, privatizing the Afghan war by Eric Prince would tremendously reduce the costs.
I've laid out this plan, this alternative, that comes in at less than 8% of what the Pentagon is spending.
Thirdly, the role of Afghanistan mineral deposits in generating revenues and making up for the war expenditure.
Look, I've got a lot of other things. I spend most of my time mining and looking for natural resources in weird places of the world. This would be a passion project. The private sector can do this. The business of America is business. It's not warfare. We've been looking for minerals, and there is an enormous mineral and energy potential in Afghanistan if you could just set security long enough. Okay, so if you have a reliable battalion in the area that can pacify an area, then you can attract the private capital to build.
So Eric Prince's alternative plan for Trump was a meaningful combination of the mines and the privatization of the Afghan war.
Now he's president. He's saying, well, they've got like $1 trillion of minerals in Afghanistan. Why don't we at least take it to pay for the war? No, that would be stealing. That would be robbing from them. Trump thinks, well, I don't like the option of leaving anymore. I don't like the option of putting in more troops. Mm-hmm. And he's, in other words, biding his time to introduce the option of, why don't we just give it to my friend Eric Prince and let him make billions of dollars off of it? That way the millions he gave us will be repaid by billions from taxpayers.
Mines and Trump were the two keywords that were meaningful in Afghanistan. Wilbur Ross was Trump's Secretary of Commerce. His interview gave a clear picture of Trump's approach toward mines in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan, it hasn't gotten, I mean, the president obviously gave his big speech recently about sending more troops there. You delivered a plan this summer to the president to get the Afghanistan economy back on its feet that relies in part on tapping into the country's estimated $1 trillion in mineral resources, trillion even by Washington standards, as you said, a lot of money. The president has said we can use some of those resources to repay us for what we've spent there. Where does the plan stand, and are we going to be able to benefit from that?
A few years ago, the U.S. Geological Survey did a survey of Afghanistan. It concluded that there was about $1 trillion of natural resources, not counting oil and gas, so copper, lithium, minerals of those sort. That's a big number. And then ultimately getting some big international mining firms to come in and do the job.
Yeah.
But what really goes on in these silent and far-fetched mountains?
We're not a new kid on the block when it comes to Afghanistan. Our first work in Afghanistan started in 1952. And we were there until about 1973. One of the things that we discovered when we started work is that there was a huge amount of mineral data available within the Ministry of Mines and Industries at that time and within the Afghan Geological Survey. This was mostly old Soviet data that went back to... We used the old Soviet data to compile the first assessment of what we call the preliminary assessment of the mineral resources of the country. That was completed in 2010. We were approached by the Department of Defense and said, and they asked us whether or not, or how could they basically increase interest in the development of these mineral resources in these boxes. And we told them, we normally do not go beyond what you see. But if you want to increase the interest, then you need to go into each one of the boxes and develop detailed information and data. We did that. This block map basically includes metallic minerals, industrial minerals, and locations for gemstones or precious stones. So it's a full look at the mineral resource assessment as we look at them in USGS. That confirmed basically that we were right in our assessment because we found what we should have found there.
Limelight.
Africa can also benefit from partnership with BRICS. South African president has said closer ties between Africa and the BRICS alliance could boost trade and investment. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, being a BRICS member has created new opportunities for South Africa as the country has